Hey folks, this is Brad Listy. I am re-airing my conversation with Shauna Mahon today. I'm very sad to report that we have lost her. She had been struggling with COVID-19, like the long-haul version of COVID-19 over the past year, had a particularly nasty case of it, and had been having a very difficult time. And from what I gather, she took her own life last week. So it's heartbreaking news. And I thought I would just share my recollection of her. I only had that one conversation with her, which is one of the strange parts of doing this show. I have these great conversations with people, and oftentimes that's it, you know? But what I remember about her was how funny she was, how vulnerable she seemed. And she had what I would characterize as survivor's energy. She had been through quite a lot. This is a person who had a spectacularly difficult childhood and lived to tell about it. And not only that, but emerged from it somehow with her sense of humor intact, with her good heart intact. She was really funny. And frankly, I'm sorry I didn't get to know her better. So if you're out there and you did know Shauna and you're grieving her loss, I send you my deepest condolences. I'm so sorry. It's terrible to lose anyone. It's always terrible to lose someone. I think it's extra hard in some ways to lose somebody to suicide. So my heart goes out to you. If you did not know Shauna Mahon, you should read her book. She left behind a beautiful novel. It is called Oh, You Pretty Things, and it is out on Dutton. So get your hands on that. It's Oh, You Pretty Things by Shauna Mahon. So, having said that, I think I'll just get to the conversation. Again, deepest sympathies to Shauna's family and friends. She will be missed, and I hope this conversation serves as a good memory of her and who she was and how she lived. This episode first aired on June 17th, 2015, and I'm playing it again for you right now. This is my conversation with Shauna Mahon.
I grew up all over the west side of Los Angeles. Literally everywhere from Venice to even into the valley, from Venice to Studio City, but and back. My mother was, depending on how, she wasn't, no one labeled her in those days. She was never diagnosed, but she was probably schizophrenic. The television, would talk to her. We would throw the television set out every few years because there were voices telling her that, this was going to happen or this was bad, and she would freak out and throw the TV away. But moving also was like a super high priority for her. She was big on fresh starts. So we moved at least once a year, sometimes only a few blocks away. But I mean, there's not an area of the west side of Los Angeles that I haven't lived in for at least a short period of time.
So wait, okay. So you're moving once a year. That's tough. That's tough on a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then was your mom, in addition to like hearing voices from the television, was she thinking like, the place that we're in, it's got a bad energy. It's haunted. And then we got to go somewhere, somewhere new.
She wasn't super juju-y like that usually, although she did believe in aliens. If an alien had come to the house, which happened not infrequently, then we would have to move.
Okay. So aliens. And you're how old hearing this? You're like, what, 5 years old?
Six? From the earliest I can remember.
And what are you thinking about these alien?
I believed her. I mean, it was just my mom and it was just me and my mom for, ever when I was a kid. So, how do you know what you don't know?
Right.
It wasn't until I was probably, I don't know exactly. I mean, it's funny. People have asked me a lot of questions, and no one's ever asked me that. When did I figure out that, there was something was amiss.
Well, first of all, it's just, it's a heavy thing to lay on a kid. There's aliens.
Yeah.
I don't need to be hearing that when I'm 5 years old, and because you're, I mean, of course you're going to believe it.
Yeah, I wasn't, that actually wasn't the worst. I mean, that didn't seem like the worst thing in the world to me, you know? I mean, I was big, you know, my first, I loved early fantasy, like the Chronicles of Narnia was like sort of my first favorite set of books. I mean, after like Little Golden Books or whatever, because the idea that there was some magical place where, you know, the forces of good and evil were very clearly delineated was very attractive to me because things were much more fluid in my house.
You're like, yeah, so, you're like, maybe these aliens are going to show up and fix things.
Totally.
Take me away.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I was big into the Narnia books, too, when I was a kid.
Oh, see, I already like you.
Yeah. No, I mean, just like the idea that you could, like, get into this, you know, go into this wardrobe and, you know, I like the whole thing. I don't know why. But now I find out, like, later in life, I learned that it was this big Christian allegory, which made
I know. How much of a bummer was that?
Well, but I mean, maybe I'm thinking, like, because I was raised Catholic, I guess you weren't, huh? You had no religion.
Well, we were every religion.
Oh, okay. You
know, in keeping with our need to move frequently, I went to Catholic school for fourth and fifth grade and a little bit of sixth grade. We were, you know, we went to the Self-Realization Fellowship Center for a while. My mom checked out Scientology. I mean, I remember reading Dianetics at a relatively early age, just going like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah, you know, it's weird. well, for, like, just to complete my thought, I think maybe like when you're reading the Narnia books as a kid and you have some education or background in Christianity, Catholicism or whatever, maybe it was working on some subconscious level. Maybe the story parallels or whatever.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I wanted to believe. I didn't start calling myself an atheist until I was in my probably 20s, 30s. I mean, the idea of something to believe, like, you know, that there's an ordained quality to the universe in however you believe that is, you know, I mean, that's very attractive. Unfortunately, I no longer believe it to be true, but,
so that's where you are. That's where you are spiritually. You're a full atheist right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's energy in the universe, but I think we live in a very chaotic, I think we live in a chaotic universe, in a chaotic world. And I don't think that there's anything that governs that in any way.
Yeah, I mean, there can't be anybody, like if anyone's, like, pulling the puppet strings, or anything is pulling the puppet strings, it's a pretty twisted thing.
Yeah, if any, you know, I'd like to have a word with that entity.
Right.
You're like, if that's the case.
You're like, I could have used some help when I was moving twice a year as a, you know, adolescent or whatever. But
or even now, I mean, you know, right. Explain basically the entire continent of Africa, or, you know, like, all of the atrocities that are being perpetrated in so many places, you know? Like,
sure.
To get, like, Lucy Ricardo, Ricky Ricardo about it. Like, you got some splaining to do if you exist.
Right. Okay. So where was dad? If it was just you and your mom, no siblings and
no siblings. I had a sister who died before I was born. She drowned in my parents' swimming pool it's funny. I just did a big phone interview and I feel like, so now I feel like I'm repeating all of this, that covered all of this, but it'll be new hopefully to your listeners. My parents had a child. I'm 51. So my parents had a child in 1960. She died in 1962. She drowned in their swimming pool. The story that I believed my entire life was that my mother had been cast as Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies and my parents were having a party. And, you know, my mother was in the kitchen with the caterers and she looked out and saw something floating in the pool and she thought it was one of my sister's dolls and went down to get it. And it was actually my sister. And they lived in Coldwater Canyon at the time. And, you know, the paramedics were called and it was too late. And then the party guests started arriving. Story I believed my whole life. After my mother died, she killed herself in 2000. She was homeless.
Oh.
Sorry. Thank you. That's very sweet.
I'm now lying down.
I've put you on the couch.
Yes.
There's going to be a bill later. yeah, I'll send you my bill. I'm not inexpensive. Anyway, that turned out to be completely untrue. But I didn't know that until after my mother was dead and I had a lunch with my father, who I saw very rarely both in my childhood and in my adulthood for two very different reasons, which I'll explain if you care to hear them. But
sure.
So I was having lunch with my father in, like, I don't know, 2005 or something. And it was right when I was just starting to write. And I said, you know, so what happened? And his story was completely different. You know, they were drunk, they were fighting, which honestly sounds like so much closer to the truth. And, you know, forensic evidence shows that, in fact, she was not ever, you know, not ever in the running to be on that show. But drunken fighting and you know, not paying attention, and who would have been my older sister drowned, and then my parents got pregnant with me like probably 3 days later. You know, I was literally born like 10 months later. So kind of doomed from the gate. You know,
God,
I mean, in terms of like healthy young childhood.
Right.
I have no early memories of my father at all.
So were your parents drinking a lot? I mean, like your mother, you said, was mentally ill, or probably was, but it was undiagnosed.
She was definitely mentally ill. What her condition was is, you know, will be speculation. You know, I mean, we'll never know. But certainly every therapist I've ever had is like, yeah, schizophrenic of one form or another, possibly paranoid schizophrenic. Which, you know, again, armchair. I mean, you can't.
And was it exacerbated with substance abuse?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. I mean, she was staunchly anti-drug, except for Valium, because my childhood pediatrician, who was a dear friend of hers, you know, prescribed them to her, and she drank pretty copiously.
Okay. So, but the thing too, I'm thinking is that you go through something horrible like that. That, like, she must have been carrying like an enormous burden of guilt.
Of course.
Like, I can't even imagine. Like, so. You know, maybe that, I guess what I'm getting at is that when something really traumatic happens to somebody, something that heavy that they carry around, that can factor into or trigger a kind of mental illness or a break. Like, I could see, I'm speaking completely, you know, with no authority. I have no medical authority here, obviously, but it just seems to make sense to me. Like, something like that could have been a big part of the equation.
Absolutely. And from everyone's account, I mean, she has and had, one has died, but she has siblings. By all accounts, she was eccentric at best throughout her own childhood and her, you know, adolescence and adulthood. But for sure, I mean, how can you not, I don't have anything to compare it to because of my, you know, like, because of the way that I was raised. But I mean, and I hope this doesn't sound just awful, but I have a 15-year-old dog who I've had since he was a puppy, and he's definitely in his golden moments right now. And the thought of my dog dying is just unhinging me. I mean, I guarantee you, when my dog dies, there's going to be a period of mourning like that. Something I've never felt before. Not that I have not felt with the death of either of my parents. And I realize that how possibly shallow that sounds, but I didn't have. I mean, this dog has, you know, been an unconditional part of my life through so much, where both of my parents sort of weren't.
Right. What kind of dog?
He's a mutt. He's either Italian Greyhound or Whippet and some kind of terrier. He's about 25 pounds.
What's his name?
Riley.
Riley. All right. I just want to get Riley. Like, we got to put Riley on the record.
Shout out for Riley.
Yeah.
Love it.
Okay. So, and your mom was it like an aspiring Hollywood actress?
Well, not by the time I came along. My mother was an actress in the 40s and 50s, or basically in the 40s. She was allegedly. Okay, here's another thing that I have to say. Like, everything has the disclaimer. I mean, just everything. Whenever I talk about either of my parents, unless I'm telling you a firsthand story of this happened to me, you know, and my mother together, it's allegedly because of my mother's whatever her illness was, and my father's. My father is at best a teller of tall tales and at worst a pathological liar.
So wait, is your father still with us?
No, he's dead.
Oh, he is. Okay.
Yeah, he died. He died just a few years ago, actually. He died in 2000, muffle, I don't know, 2008 or 9.
Okay. So, but mom was like, she was an actress in the 40s and 50s, you think?
Mm-hmm. She definitely was. I mean, you know, you can IMDb her and see some of her. She was a contract actress. The I think part was she believed she was a contract actress for MGM. She has a handful of roles that, you know, nothing big, She was, you know, she was like a substitute little rascal there for a while. You know, she has a couple of those episodes, and she did a handful of movies where she always was always like, you know, someone's little sister or whatever.
And what was her name?
Beverly Hudson.
Okay. If anybody wants to look that up. And so, okay. And then your dad, what did he do?
My father, well, my grandfather, I'm sure you've done research. You probably know this, but my grandfather was, wow, did that sound snotty?
don't overestimate me.
I'm sure you've already looked me up. My grandfather was one of the founders of the Screenwriters Guild, which was the original, you know, the precursor to the Writers Guild that exists today. Very famous screenwriter, wrote, you know, The Captain's Courageous and Heaven Knows Mr. Allison and, you know, all kinds of amazing. He didn't really, like, he and my father did not have a close relationship. My father grew up in boarding schools in Connecticut and came out summers to, you know, go fishing with like John Huston and John Wayne and my grandfather. And my father idolized my grandfather. So tried,
and
of course,
what was your,
to follow.
What was your grandfather's name?
John Lee Mayen.
Okay.
Are you frantically? Are you? Like,
I'm googling.
Yeah, I'm googling as we speak. Right? So, I appreciate a podcast that flies by the seat of its pants.
Oh, absolutely. It's my MO. So, but you know, but like you have some Hollywood bloodlines. Like you have you
for sure.
Okay, and so you grew up knowing that, and did you have a sense that like, oh, I'm going to be a part of this too?
No, I mean, the interesting thing, or that is the worst lead in the world. The interesting thing is, no, it's not necessarily an interesting thing. I'll be the judge of that. It's interesting to me, that, now I've forgotten what's interesting or not, but the answer is no, I did not have that. There was no expectation on my part. There was always a deep yearning. I mean, fame was absolutely a family value in my house. And my mother, by the time I was growing up, my mother and I lived, as I said, in a series of, you know, basically shitty one bedroom and studio apartments all over the West Side. While my father remarried briefly a relatively wealthy woman, I assume, because they lived in this, you know, like really sort of fancy little castle house up in the Bird Streets. And my grandfather, of course, was sort of firmly ensconced in his, you know, in his Beverly Glen ranch house that, you know, that all of those films purchased for him, although he was basically retired at that point. And my mother's sister married a very well-known character actor of the time, Keenan Wynn. And so they had, you know, like this big giant old house in the flats of Brentwood. And, you know, we were always like, which one of these things is not like the others? Right. And so it always seemed, you know, sort of looking at that. And of course, they of course had all of their own problems inside of their own homes, which I was not really privy to, but occasionally privy to, but mostly not. But the grass always seemed so much greener. And my mother was very, very bitter that, you know, like her ship had sort of, you know, sailed in and then sailed out and left her on the dock. So although she didn't aspire for me to be an actress, which I don't know if you've read the book, but don't answer that. I don't want to know if you've read the book. I'm assuming that you've read the book and adored it.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Sorry, there's my squeaky chair. But the character of the mother in this book is not my mother at all. Although certainly there were, you know, there are a few mannerisms that just slipped in. But my mother did not. My mother wanted me to have an education. My mother did not want me to have a Hollywood life.
So she had that value for you too. I mean,
absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. She wasn't, you know, there are no angels and devils, you know, I mean, yeah, it was a crazy, traumatic, fucked up, hard childhood, but there, you know, there are also benefits to having, you know,
but you also had, proximity to all this affluence too, which is a weird way, you know, it's weird to have, I mean, relative affluence, right?
Absolutely. And I honestly wouldn't wish that on anyone.
No, I was just going to say it's actually especially hard to be, you know, not affluent or poor, to put it, you know, more bluntly, But to have access and proximity to those who aren't, because, you know, it heightens the difference. You know, when you actually get to see what you're missing, it makes it harder, you know?
Sure. Oh, no, absolutely. And particularly, I mean, when you're a kid, when I was a kid, I mean, when you are a kid, I speaking in generalities, but for me, I always went to very fancy, I went to a string, mostly, of very fancy schools that were usually on, and again, allegedly, but on full scholarships. If I wasn't on a full scholarship, I have no idea where we obtained the money, because my mother was basically a secretary and unemployed for most of my, for all of my childhood and adolescence.
Well, who was like, what about you? What about your grandfather? Like, he had some money. Wasn't he taking care of you?
No, he was not. He did not. He, I saw him very rarely, and he, you know, he had such a fraught relationship with my father. My father would come and pick me up and sort of like, you know, take me over there as like a prop, you know?
Yeah, he's like, I need a buffer.
Totally. And he, and my grandfather was very kind to me. I mean, you know, I think that sort of tends to happen, or at least I watched it happen with my father. Like, my father was an asshole. And I understand why my father was an asshole, because he didn't, you know, he didn't get the tools from his dad, and he didn't go out and forge those tools himself. So, you know, I mean, I understand why my father was what he was, but my father was not a great father when I was growing up. But the later interactions that I had with him, as infrequent as they were, he had a longtime girlfriend. They were together for 40 years before he died. And she has 4 sons, and they now have children. And he was sort of great with those grandkids.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I get it. Like, it sort of skips, you know, like, you don't feel the pressure. It skips a generation, you know, like, you skip that generation where you don't feel like you're make or break. I mean, I was going to go off onto a tangent of like why I think my father was the way he was with me, but that's like, it's boring. I don't want to do that. But,
you're living with your mom most of the time. I'm starting to understand clearly why you would drop out of high school. You just had to get out, right?
Well, yes. And there were, I mean, well, I started self-medicating too. I mean, you know, my mother, I mean, the good parts of living with a schizophrenic woman are that, you know, she comes home on New Year's Day and says, like, we're going to go get you a pony, you know, and so you draw, you know, like, which get me a pony means we're just going to go ride a pony. She can't actually buy me a pony, but, you know, the talk of it all, you know, like, or whirlwind, like, get in the car, we're going to San Diego. And, you know, she was very spontaneous and, you know, There were those sort of things that were sort of magical. Like, one night she stayed up all night, and something that, you know, these are all pieces too that I feel like I'm cannibalizing, because I've worked on a memoir, which is not this book, but there's this other book, this memoir.
I was going to say, you need to write a memoir. If anybody is qualified to write a memoir, it's you.
Yeah, thanks. You and Alexandra Jacobs. I don't know if you read the New York Times review. I just had a review in the New York Times this past Sunday, which, I mean, thank you, New York Times, my third on this book, which is fucking amazing and unheard of. And I cry. I'm probably going to cry just thinking about it right now. But this last one was a little less than kind. She had some salient points, but at the end she said, I wonder if there's not a memoir in here.
Right.
It's like, well, yeah. I mean, we're working on it.
Yeah. You're like, just you wait, Alexandra.
Yeah.
Wow. So high school, dropping out, things coming to a head at some point.
Well, so understand. So I had gone from fourth grade, fifth grade at this Catholic school, a moment of public school in sixth grade. And then my mother, I was a gifted child. I think, you know, for sure, like, years of bad decisions and hard living have put me much more onto the level of just sort of average. But without question, you know, I mean, part of the reason that I was getting these scholarships at all these fancy schools in town was because I was gifted.
What schools are we talking?
Well, the first school my elementary school was Carl Thorpe, which is this little $30,000 a year school on San Vicente in Santa Monica. And when I went there, they skipped me from kindergarten right into the second grade, and that didn't work out well for me. Again, which one of these things is not like the others, both economically and size-wise? You know, I
What, you were a big child?
No, I was not a big child. I was a small child. So, I mean, I was a normal sized child, but when you take a kid from a kindergarten class and put him into a second grade class, like from a 5-year old to a 7-year old.
God, how horrible is that? I was immediately thinking like, wow, they're judging kids in first grade. And
they're like, hey, fat kid.
Jesus.
Wait, Brad Listy, I mean, and I am a large woman now. I was like, Brad Listy, did you just call me fat?
No. I'm thinking of my daughter, like, going into school. Like, they've already got body stuff happening in first grade. I'm, like, dreading it because she's 4. But, okay. So, but that makes me happy, actually. So, you were tiny because you were
I was I was the little kid, of course, because I was playing with, I was 5, and I was on the playground with second graders. Like, nobody wants the 5-year-old in the dodgeball pick,
Right.
Plus, which one of these things is not like the others? Just when there's that much of a sociological, or economical chasm between you and, 99.7% of the student body, I felt it. I mean, I absolutely felt it just in terms of like what's in your lunchbox or what clothes are you wearing or who picks you up from school or, all of those things. I mean, even at a very young age, I was profoundly aware of those differences.
Oh,
And then we tripped along through, lesser, like I went to St. Monica's, which, again, is sort of like a relatively affluent Catholic school in Santa Monica. But the school where it all really went sideways for me was when I attended, it was called Brentwood Academy. Now it's just called the Brentwood School. On Sunset and Barrington in Brentwood, and it was sort of the repository. It had been a military academy that had just recently switched over to being a co-ed, quote, prep, unquote, school, and really it was kind of a repository for like super rich kids and that may or may not have be dealing with some behavioral issues.
Oh, which, really? Was it like, so it was like for problem children?
I mean, actually, I can't necessarily say that. I certainly gravitated toward the problem children. So 7th grade, 8th grade, 9th grade, overachiever, total social outcast. I mean, like for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is, most of those kids come from other feeder schools. Like they come from Curtis and like, I honestly can't even remember the names of, if you've got a 4-year-old, I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. If you're sort of looking at like, how do you place a child in,
right.
You live in, in the Los Angeles school system world. And plus I was, I'd been raised by a schizophrenic woman. So, and I'd changed schools at least once a year, every year. So, it was traumatic for me, but it was also probably the best learning experience that I had because there were sort of like gifted classes and non, and that was all going swimmingly until the summer between 9th and 10th grade when, things, my mother was deteriorating for sure and becoming more and more violent. And, she used to threaten to kill herself all the time, but she would also threaten to kill both of us. And, there was definitely like, I had a little PTSD thing going on, which I refer to it now and it sounds kind of glib, but that's because I've had 15 years of therapy. Right. I can speak about it and not, not have it be like, oh, and then there's this very dramatic thing that I have to tell you because it just, I'm certainly not alone and it is what it is. But I feel like I had to sort of throw that disclaimer in there because I'm not to minimize. It was fucked up.
Yeah.
But so summer between 9th and 10th grade, I'd actually made a friend in the summer in the school year of 9th grade who was I'm just going to name her because I already named her for this other thing. And I hope we haven't spoken in years and I have nothing but lovely things to say about her. So I hope she's not horrified or offended, but Julie Andrews' daughter, Emma Walton, became a dear friend of mine in the 9th grade. And she was healthy. And, now in hindsight, now that I know so many actors and their offspring and what have you, I know how difficult, how difficult it can be to raise confident, healthy children in, when you're living in that Hollywood environment. But she was lovely. Her parents were lovely. And they were very, very kind to me for basically my whole 9th grade school year. And then they went off to Stad for the summer, and I could not go along. And
of course they did. Where else is Julie Andrews going to go but, you know, Gestad?
Yeah. And that was the summer of my, you know, that was when I discovered that drugs were really, you know, like that was just a much faster way to, you know, I mean, prior to that, my drugs of choice had been books, really, and immersing myself in schoolwork and, you know, anything that would let me completely sort of check out. And when I discovered drugs and horses, I had a brief horse riding stint that year with Emma because, you know, they were very kind to me with their horses.
Right.
But yeah, drugs and boys, like that, you know, that was like the rocket ship to, I can check the fuck out of here.
Right.
So when I came back to the Brentwood School, they were a little like, oh, scholarship child, what's happened to you? You know,
what were you doing? What kind of drugs were you doing?
Well, oh my God. Well, so first of all, and the statute of limitations has got to be up right now, so I feel comfortable saying this. I mentioned that childhood pediatrician, who, by the way, we lived with for a while. And side note on him, he was this lovely gay man who was completely closeted because it was, you know, like, I mean, when I was a kid, it was the 60s, but now we're moving up into the 70s. But he had this beautiful house in Malibu with like these two white grand pianos that faced each other. And I mean, he, you know, he definitely had like a whole Liberace vibe, and he liked to have, and he, you know, and he had a predilection for younger boys who were always his nephews or, you know, what have you. Anyway, we lived in his pool house for a while. And when I fell in with this little crowd that was, you know, that was drinking, and there was the kid's father who was a dentist, so we had access to nitrous oxide, which was awfully fun, but also awfully dangerous, you know, because you just sort of fill up a balloon with it and just inhale it until you just fall over.
Right.
But, and this, again, I'm dating myself, but this is back in the era of Quaaludes and, you know, like Placidils and Tuinols and all these crazy downers that were still relatively easy to get. So I would steal his, or appropriate, if you will, I mean, it was stealing, but he just left them around the house. I mean, I would take his, and also this was
like,
way
like
before.
Like in a candy bowl?
Not drugs, prescription pads.
Oh, okay.
And so we knew this guy who had an older brother who had flunked out of being of like EMT school, and he would write the prescriptions and we would go and fill them. And, you know, like the oldest looking among us would go and fill them. And then I would sell them. You know, and take them, and also copiously take them. So I was taking anything. I was not a Coke girl, although I dabbled. I had my moments, but, you know, not a Coke girl, but definitely like any downery kind of thing that would just, you know, that would create a scrim between me and the outside world, I'm in.
Yeah.
I was a horrible drinker. I was like, you know, I would drink two beers and throw up in the back of, you know, like whoever's BMW. Sorry. You
know? So drugs, did it ever get to the point where you had to get sober?
Well, I stopped drinking. I stopped doing drugs. I mean, I stopped doing drugs pretty early on. I stopped doing drugs when I was, I don't know, 19 or 20. And then I got married, to my first husband, which was not, you know, he was a lovely man, but, you know, it was sort of out of the frying pan and into the fire of which one of these things is not like the others, because he was relatively wealthy, and I felt like I couldn't, like I was just not measuring up to, you know, like I couldn't create the lifestyle that he wanted his housewife to create.
Right.
And, so then I started drinking, and I, you know, I figured out how to drink without throwing up in the back of someone's BMW or my own.
Got the hang of it.
Yeah. Got the hang of the whole drinking thing. And then, it, you know, and that was pre-therapy. So at one point I stopped drinking. I didn't drink for, I'm an embellisher, at least 10 years. Somehow it's grown to 13, but I actually think it's like more like 10 or 11 because it just, you know, like it just had stopped working in my life. And concurrently with that, however, I got into therapy and started doing all the work to make myself not self-destructive. But in long-winded answer to your question, yes, I didn't. I was actively sober for about 10 years.
Right.
And I am no longer. I actually now drink with, you know, and it's been that way for about 5 years. So the jury's still out. Check back with me.
Okay.
Check back with me in a while.
But it's more controlled.
Absolutely. I mean, well, I don't have, you know, I mean, I'm a writer and I'm neurotic and I still have, you know, I still have big storm clouds of lack of self-esteem that come blowing through the house and knock me sideways.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sure none whatsoever. but I don't have the desire to obliterate myself the way that I did before I dealt with, you know, before I dealt with all the shit from my childhood.
Well, you know, that's the thing about it is that, like, it's one thing to get sober, but if you just get sober but you don't do any of the work to find out why you were self-destructive in the first place, you got to have some therapy too somehow, right?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think I think there are plenty of people who don't do that, and you know, I mean, just because you're sober doesn't mean you're not an asshole.
Right, exactly. You know? That's what I'm saying. Like, you can be sober, but it's like you haven't really even gone in and, you know, investigated. You know,
Further, just because you're sober doesn't mean that you're happy. You know, I mean, like, you get that happy moment, but then you still have all of the same. I mean, I think, without speaking about any programs in particular, because, you know, they have rules about that, that I still feel compelled to follow, sort of, not really. The idea is taking responsibility for your own actions that ultimately help you alleviate the, like, you know, the giant anvil of shame that is pretty universal when you're so self-destructive that you're drinking and using drugs on a regular basis. There's usually, like, a big, you know, like, anvil of shame that you're carrying around on your back. So when you do that work and that gets lifted to some degree, there's still all of, like, I mean, there's to me, I never found a place in that avenue of sobriety. The therapy working in therapy along with it was so important to me, because where do you deal with all the anger?
Right.
You know, like, where do you deal with all of, you know, with all of that stuff? And that wasn't something that I found in, you know, in a program of sobriety, but it was certainly what it took me a decade to work through in therapy. And it's not, and it wasn't like, you know, I didn't get a certificate, you know, it's not like cured on my wall. I mean, that's definitely going to be life work for me forever. You know,
you've got to be so pissed off.
Well, yeah, I mean, and which doesn't mean that I don't have big, big moments of empathy and sympathy and all of it. But sometimes when I find myself in a particularly dark place, or I see myself reacting in a way, you know, like that sometimes that sort of moment that happens outside of yourself where I'm watching my really bad behavior going, like, why the fuck am I doing this right now? And then pretty quickly after, I can sort of, like, trace it back to, well, you know, of course, like, I didn't feel safe in this circumstance. So when I find, you know, as a child, so now when I find myself in this circumstance as an adult, it's going to bring up, you know, it's going to bring up those feelings. And then, you know, even though I have forgiveness for both my mother and my father, I get that moment where I'm like, you know what, fuck you.
Right.
Like, fuck you for never letting me be a kid.
Yeah.
And fuck you to all of my mother's siblings and everyone else who in subsequent years after my mother died said, it's amazing that you're, you know, like, we're so proud of you, because, I mean, it was such a mess and it's so, you know, like, you really transcended and, like, we didn't know how you were going to do it. It's like, really, you didn't? Because you were a fucking grown up and I was four. So why didn't you step in?
Right.
You know, which unfortunately makes me that person in Walmart. There's a kid getting yanked along by the arm or told to shut the fuck up. I 100%, like 100% of the time, step in. Sometimes too, and I try to be gracious about it. I try to be empathetic to the woman who's doing it or the man. But I mean, like, I can't. I feel like if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the fucking problem.
Right, right. I like that.
So,
people need to take more action and do something rather than just think about it. You know, I think that for whatever reason, it's hard though to get people to do it. It's like, there's something I think about this with regard to social justice issues or poverty or whatever. It's like, and I think about it about myself. It's like, I could be doing more. Like,
yeah.
I think about it a lot, but there's some, you know, it's hard to take action. And I think at the level of personal inconvenience, people tend to balk, you know. It's like, you got to be willing to make sacrifice. You got to be willing to experience discomfort, you know, whether it's like, because it's uncomfortable to go up to somebody in Walmart and be like, excuse me, you know, like, and to kind of insert yourself into that situation. But,
yeah,
you know, I'm glad you do.
I usually go to the kid. Like, I usually go to the kid and get down on the kid's level and go, like, hi, sweetheart, and get ready, you know, like, also with eyes in the back of my head that I'm potentially about to get hit, which,
right,
by the way, no one has ever done. I've had women tell me to fuck off and get the fuck away from their kid, you know, and then I've turned and said, like, are you okay? Can I get you something? Like, I know this is like, this must be really hard, you know, but a few other times I've been like, you know what? Like, you're scarring your fucking kid for life.
Right.
Just think about it.
Yeah.
You know?
So what happened with your mother? Like, what happened to her once you left home?
I left home at a relatively early, okay. How much time do we have? Because, dude, like, I could do this all day long.
Well, no, I mean, you know, we have some time.
I'm going to give you the Reader's Digest version. When I was 13 and I was still attending the Brentwood School, it was that summer. It was that fateful summer between 9th and 10th grade. I had a boyfriend and I got pregnant. And I had an abortion. And somehow in there, my mother had lost a job and was losing her apartment. So she came to live with my boyfriend and me and I and...
Wait, where were you guys living?
Also in Brentwood. My mother was living in an apartment that she was managing in sort of Baja Westwood. And my boyfriend, whose name... Well, I'm not even going to say it, but it was such a great name. Not appropriate. Don't want to do that to him. But it was like one of those names like, oh, they named you after a president, like literally first, last, and, you know, first, middle, and last name. So
oh, wow.
Odd.
Okay.
Yeah.
Richard Nixon.
Right. So my boyfriend, Richard Milhouse Nixon, also lived with his older boss. They worked construction. And somehow my mother met that boss at a bar. And then, you know, I mean, this is just one of those, like, you know, crazy stories of my life. I ended up moving in with us. And then I broke up with that boy. He moved back to Malibu, where his parents raised bees. The other guy wanted my mom out. And so we tracked down my father, who I had not seen in years. And my father was living with the woman who he spent virtually the rest of his life with and one of her sons, and having like a whole, you know, life. He was working as an editor. My father, which I never finished with that, but my father was sort of a failed everything. Like, he was, you know, he had directed one movie. He wrote a bunch of screenplays that didn't sell. He had moderate, like, he was able to make a living as a film editor, but nothing, you know, like, nothing transcendent. Like, he wasn't like Woody Allen's right-hand guy or anything, you know?
Right.
So my mother, we tracked my father down and she was like, you've got to take her, you know, she's running amok. And so I moved in with my father for about a year, and my timeline's a little iffy. Like, it was up to the point, so I must've been 15, and then I got a, you know, because I was able to get a car, and then I moved out on my own. And my mother just sort of scattered to the winds at that point. And later, she moved to Las Vegas with her older brother, who had been a very successful prop master in the business in Los Angeles, but also an inveterate gambler and kind of bookie. And again, he's dead, so I guess I'm allowed to say that. So he moved to Vegas to actually be a bona fide bookie, or perhaps an, I don't know, whatever. And she followed him there, and she lived with him for quite a while. He was the only one who could sort of talk her down, like, you know, be like, Beverly, just... like, stop it. You know, he was really sort of good at managing her. And then he died and she moved into her van and she lived the rest of her life in her van. You know, she was a security guard at the Best Western Mardi Gras Hotel in Vegas for a little while, which is really scary when you think about her, you know, schizophrenic proclivities.
This is the one we want. This is the one we want holding the line at the casino.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I see you, alien creature down there, you know. I mean, like, it's kind of funny when it's Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith, but, like, when it's my mom, I don't know. Like, it's not exactly a Men in Black moment. And I would speak to her occasionally, but she was just so, like, she had deteriorated to a point that she barely made sense, you know? I mean, everything was conspiratorial and I tried. I mean, I tried to get her help. I tried to. I mean, I did. I tried a few different things. She didn't want it. And anyway, so we didn't speak forever. And until I got the call that she had run her van that she was living in into the side of a building in, you know, one of those shitty like bars that doesn't have any windows, like off the strip in Vegas.
That's what she did.
Yeah.
No seatbelt, just drove at a high speed.
Yeah, just drove it. Yeah, drove it straight in.
Good God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which was what she'd always threatened to do to both of us. You know, she'd always said like, well, you know, we can, she has a few like grandiose statements, and occasionally I find myself making them, or and also mispronunciations. Like she called espresso demi-tasse, but she pronounced it demi-tasse, which I carried with me for like a super long time. And until someone had, you know, some demi-tasse, like what the fuck is that? Or she would also say, it's time for us to shuffle off this mortal coil. Also, she used to say when I was a little kid, it's a great day for the banana fish. And it wasn't until I read J.D. Salinger. I mean, the first time I read that book, are you fucking kidding me?
Oh, my God. Wow. That is terrible. How troubled.
My favorite part, though, is that you have like laughter in your voice, because it's, you know, I mean, it's terrible, but it's also fucking funny.
Yeah, I mean, it's like beyond belief, you know, and it's also, it's like for a kid that age to be saying that to a kid that age is just twisted.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons that I'm such a huge fan of Carrie Fisher's, like both her, you know, like her one woman show and the writing that she does, where she sort of says, you know, like if it wasn't funny, it would just be true, and that is unacceptable.
Yeah,
and I think that all of my work has that, and I have to fight against you know, armoring with it. But the truth is, like, shit like that's funny. I mean, it's dark and awful, but it's also really kind of funny.
Did you say?
Sometimes.
Are you talking about Carrie Fisher's one woman show where she's like barefoot and just like talking on stage?
Yes.
That was hilarious.
So good, right?
Yeah, she's a character.
Yeah.
And I love the part, like, I didn't realize, like, one of the parts of it that made me laugh so hard was when she was talking about why Princess Leia has that British accent. And I didn't realize, like, she had just been, like, in acting school in London and she was, like, 20 years old.
Right.
And she was, like, all affected and thought it was cool and, like, she thought she was British.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, and that's
like,
why.
Like Madonna. And
yeah,
like,
exactly, exactly. And she's just, I mean, that was hysterical. So, I'm reading on your website that you... you say you've transcended a lifetime of shitty jobs. I want to read I'm going to read the list of jobs that you've had, and then we're going to try to discuss some of this. Dog walker, cook, telemarketer, celebrity personal assistant, theme restaurant waitress, and I think we've already discussed failed drug dealer.
Yes.
So you've done
also magician's assistant.
Of course,
somehow that fell off of that list, and I've got to go back and put that back in there.
Yeah, you can't forget magician's assistant. Is this at like the Magic Castle or something, or?
Oh, not. I mean, really, more like bat mitzvahs and bar, you know, and children's birthday parties. But he was a member of the Magic Castle, and we have done a couple. I did get to, you know, like load a couple of dove pans in the, you know, like in the small room.
Right,
and that's and I'm actually being facetious, because if you're not allowed to use those kind of tricks at the magician's at the Magic Castle, but yes,
okay.
It wasn't like I wasn't working for David Copperfield. Let's put it that way.
Okay, you weren't on the strip.
Yeah,
but celebrity personal assistant.
Yes, well, that's the overarching theme of my. I mean, well, actually, the overarching theme of my book is our cultural. If I've done it right, is our cultural obsession with celebrity. I mean, I think that, you know, I think that as a nation, if not as a planet, we are, you know, more obsessed with fame and famous people than we ever have been. And I think part of that is the advent of, you know, the immediacy of social media and how everyone is paparazzi and how everyone is, you know, everyone is a reporter, because you can just, you know, like pop up on your blog and be like, here's a picture that I just saw of, you know, so-and-so like taking a leak in the alley behind Dantana's, you know, whereas 30 or 40 years ago, that stuff was much more controlled. And again, fame being that family value that it was in my house, I gravitated toward that insanity. And right. I was a personal assistant for a lot of years.
Okay, I find that's not that uncommon. Maybe I'm saying something really obvious, but I've noticed that like Los Angeles families where the parents are in entertainment, there's just such a strong, like you say, fame is a family value. Every kid in the family really wants to be famous, or it seems like, you know, or a lot of them do. And it's kind of expected, like that's what you pursue. And I remember when I was teaching at Santa Monica College, I would like take a poll. I would just be curious and like go off script and be like, "What do you guys want to do? You know, like what do people think they want to do with their lives?" And a solid majority wanted to be in film and television, acting.
What I really want to do is direct.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like all, like literally, that's all they could think of. And I mean, those are fun jobs, I guess. I mean, it's a lot of people wouldn't want them if they, you know, they have a high reward at least in terms of money and you know, I guess they take a lot away from you too, but that doesn't get analyzed as much. And I don't know, it seems sort of depressing to me.
When I moved back from San Francisco after my first marriage crumbled, I didn't know what I was going to do. And I fell into being a personal assistant because I had a friend who...
For whom?
Here's the thing. This book is fiction. And somewhere accidentally, it was called A Romana Clay. And I mean, the book's fiction. And... I've never been a person, when people ask who I work for prior to my writing about it, I always said, like, you want me to tell you who I worked for, or you want me to tell you the fun and, you know, like scandalous stories? And people would always say, like, oh, I want to hear the scandalous stories. And it's like, yeah, then I'm not going to tell you who I worked for, because, you know, like, those aren't my stories to tell. And like, I mean, they are on the one hand, but outing that person isn't my deal.
Right.
Then when I wrote this book, it's such a pastiche. All the characters are such composite characters of all of the people that I've worked for and been around and spent time in the room with. And so if I tell you who I worked for, then inevitably, not you, but I mean, how I feel about this book is, if I say who I worked for, then you're going to assign that person to a character in this book. And that's just not... That does both that person a disservice, because it's A, it's not true, and B, like, it you're doing yourself a disservice, because you should be formulating your own, you know, like your own idea of who that person is in your mind.
I gotcha. So, but let's just for the sake of the podcast, like, you have worked for actors, directors.
I've worked for actors, composers, a director. A couple of producers, mostly actors, and you know, and when I say actors, I mean actors and actresses.
Okay, but people that like that are very famous that the average person would know.
Yes.
Okay. And if you
were so inclined and you really wanted to dig deep with your Google finger, you could figure a few things out.
Okay, so give me a story. What's like some? I mean, what did you see? And then, well, first of all, give me just a couple of anecdotes of the absurdities that you might have to confront when you're in that world and working in that role.
One of the worst things that I personally have ever had to do is collect a stool sample, by which I mean stand outside a bathroom door and have a bag of human shit handed to me, but then take it and put it into. You know, like it was a parasite test. So there are like five little tiny vials that come with like little tiny, like almost like cocaine scoops from the 70s, you know, in that are in the lid of each one. And so you sort of have to dig in, and there's fluid in each of those five vials. And you have to, you know, like scoop the poop into the little vial and then shake it, agitate it for 90 seconds. And, you know, and then put it in its own little case. And then of course it has to go like directly to the lab. So, like, I've been that person, which was, you know, I mean, that's about as low as it gets. Yeah. I've cleaned up more dog shit than anyone ever, you know, and I'm a dog person, but, you know, like, actors, for whatever reason, at least many of the actors that I've worked for, just take a certain pride in their dog being untrained. And it's like, really? You know, I mean, like, So there's just dog shit all over your floor all the time. I mean, there's usually a few people working in the house, but it's like, oh, you know, like princess shit on the, you know, Obison rug again. It's like, really? Because every time I have to have that fucking thing cleaned, it's $1,000. And then it's like, why are my household bills so high? Dude, because your dog's untrained and you let him shit on the rug every five, you know, and also stop feeding him people food.
Right. You know? Yeah. People who don't train their dogs properly. Like you talked about interrupting people in Walmart who are mistreating their children or whatever. If I see somebody, like one of the things, it's a weird pet peeve, but somebody who repeats a command to a dog who's like, sit, sit, sit.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, no, like I have to stop. And you, you know, you're basically training the dog to not respond to you on the first command.
You're training the dog that he does not have to pay attention to you.
Yes, exactly.
For at least the first four or five.
Yeah. It drives me crazy. It drives me crazy. I don't understand why people even have pets if they're not going to take the time to like properly, you know, because here's the thing, just to get on my soapbox, if you don't take the time to properly train your dog, you're making the dog's life worse.
Yeah.
Because no one's going to want to be around it. They're going to think it's annoying.
Well, and I mean, I think the same could be said for children, although I do not have any, but you know, you see that behavior, you see people where, you know, it's like, mommy, can I have this? Mommy, can I have this? Mommy, can I have this? No, 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 no. Well, okay. It's like, yep, you just pretty much taught your kid that if they just push it, they're going to get it.
Yeah. No, you got to draw the line. So, you know, like for, I wanted to hear like an anecdote. And then the other thing, the other part of that question is like having gone through these years working as a personal assistant and seeing, you know, celebrity and privilege in close proximity, like hyper celebrity, hyper privilege or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is there something you learned like about these kinds of people? Are there like general takeaways about like who they tend to be personality wise or what the life does to them? Or do you know what I'm saying? Like, what did you learn?
One of the things that I learned that was relatively surprising to me is, and again, this is empirical evidence, but it's anecdotal. It's no data here, just anecdotal. But I find that the cooler the person appears on the outside, like the more of the people they appear to be on the outside, the more neurotic they are, for sure. Like, the girl who comes in and goes like, oh, you know, like, can I get a big giant piece of that pizza? And then like, you know, it's like, oh no, I don't need a chair. I'll just sit on the floor and, you know, whatever. Like that inevitably behind the gates of her home is the biggest fucking diva ever, ever.
Well, that's weird. I guess it's like a compensatory. It's like a,
yeah, I mean, virtually every actress, not only every actress I've ever worked for, but it's kind of endemic. I mean, you know, like you read it everywhere. It's like, oh, I'm such a nerd.
Yeah,
that's one of my you're not
right.
You're not, and you never have been, and you can't lay claim to that.
Right.
I reject you. I reject your nerd claim.
Well, right. I mean, I feel like I hear this from models all the time. Like, oh, I had no boyfriends in high school.
Uh-huh.
It's like shut it, please.
Yeah. Exactly.
You were like a 5, you know, just gorgeous, like genetically perfect specimen. Like, there's no way that you were a complete outcast. So you know, at some point you say goodbye to all that and you get into writing. I'm curious, like, was this something that you always had in the back of your mind that you wanted to do, and it just took you a while to get to it, or was it something that kind of dawned on you later in life and you picked it up and realized you had an affinity for it and it was something you enjoyed?
This is our Barbara Walters moment, because I rarely am able to say this in any incarnation without somehow getting teary about it. But here it comes. I didn't think that girls like me got to do things like that. You know, I mean, I was an avid reader from the time that I was, my mother taught me how to read. You know, my mother started teaching me how to read when I was 2. When I hit kindergarten, I was reading fluently. Like, she was like, okay, bedtime stories are over for you. You got this. Like, I'll be on the sofa bed with the Chablis. Here are the books, like, knock yourself out. Which, I mean, to some degree was a gift.
Right.
I mean, you know, while books were an absolutely integral part of, and we didn't have the money. I didn't have a babysitter. I mean, from the time that I was going to Carl Thorpe, like, I would walk, you know, the 12 blocks at 6 down to the Santa Monica Public Library and wait there until she got off her job at 5:30 and picked me up at 6 o'clock. So, I mean, books were everything to me, but, and like, total lump in my throat when I say it, like, I didn't think that I got to, you know, I was a high school dropout who like dealt drugs and like fucked a lot of random boys for a long time. You know, like, I got this, are you in? I'm gesturing to myself right now. I'm probably hitting the mic, but you know, like, I didn't, my self-worth was so infinitesimally low or infinitesimal that it never occurred to me that anything that I actually had to say would would be able to put that together in any sort of comprehensive manner and tell a story worth telling. Plus, you know, blah, blah. There's a lot of shame in my, you know, in my, that was all a secret for me for a long time. I mean, one of the reasons that I'm uber forthcoming about, you know, all of that, like it's so easy for me to talk to you as I just did in this podcast, is I had to like completely let go of the idea that all of that was shameful to me in some way. But I carried that until into my 30s, into my mid 30s, where, you know, like, what am I going to write about? And I tried, you know, like, I don't know, maybe in my late 20s, I sort of tried to write like a few short stories, but I wasn't willing to, consciously or subconsciously, I wasn't willing to allow any of my actual truth into it, because that was just too shameful and, you know, and ugly, and who would want to see that? So somewhere along the line, say maybe, I don't know, 4 or 5 years into active therapy, it was, I sort of had the, you know, the tiny little glimmer that maybe I wanted to, you know, that I wanted to write. And in the meantime, I mean, earlier I'd always been sort of high functioning in my jobs, and you know, like, I have that list of jobs, which are all true, of, you know, like all the shitty jobs that I had, but I also had, you know, like, I also had a few sort of great jobs where, like, I worked for the Skechers in their design department and basically did, like, you know, like, I wrote all of the PR stuff for the senior vice president of design, like all the things that she was supposed to write, you know, like I did all her interviews and that kind of stuff. And people would always say, like, oh my God, you're so, you know, like, you're so funny, you're so incisive, you're so great. But it was just, it all just sort of went like, yeah, yeah, over the top of my head, until I had enough therapy under my belt that I could say that it just seemed like maybe that terrifying thing of putting myself out there wasn't like, maybe I could actually do it.
And look at you now.
And look, living the dream.
Hey, reviewed in the New York Times. I mean, come on, you're doing it.
Yeah. Well, no, it was, I mean, I have to, and I as long as I always do, I have to give a huge, you know, shout out to my first mentor, Samantha Dunn, who, you know, I took a class at UCLA and I didn't have the prerequisites for it. Like, I heard her speak at an open house there, and I thought, whatever she's teaching, I'm going to take it, mostly because I just want to see if I can get her to be my friend, because she was so funny and so accessible. And she talked about growing up in a trailer park in New Mexico and, you know, with a very complicated mother. And I just was very drawn to her. And I ended up in that class with 30 pages of my journal that I had spent, you know, like 2 weeks taking out most of the dudes and the swearing because let's face it, I talk like a 14-year-old Valley girl. And I'm at 51, I've just sort of resigned myself to that. it's a defense mechanism for sure. But
wait, what is? I don't think you talk too much like a Valley girl.
You don't? No. You're the first, really?
I mean, well, there.
don't make me have a crush on you, Brad Listy.
But what's a defense mechanism about it?
Just, you know, that, go ahead and judge me on my, you know, on the way that I present myself, so that if you're actually going to judge me on something that matters to me, I can push you away and go like, oh, well, of course, because I talk like a Valley girl.
Oh,
you know
right.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, still dealing with shame. It's so much less than it was, but still dealing with shame of my lack of education and, you know, and moving through the literary community, moving through the literary world as I did over the past 10 years, which, you know, this book that's out right now is relatively commercial, and I'm proud of it. I mean, and I wrote it that way. I mean, I wrote that book to sell, but the memoir that I worked on for a long time, I did not. I mean, the memoir that I worked on for a long time was completely from the heart. And it was also an education. I mean, I basically got an MFA while I was trying to write that book, because, you know, so I took that first class at UCLA in 2006, and Sam, I gave her these 30 pages from my journal. And when she handed it back to me, instead of it being, you know, sort of all marked up and full of notes and whatever, it just said, call me. And it had her phone number on the back. And so I did. And she said, so you're already functioning as a writer. Like, what's your deal? And of course I cried. I'm a crier. You know, it's amazing that I've not cried in the hour that we spent together so far.
There's still time.
Yeah, there is. You'll, you know, it wouldn't take much for you to get it out of me. I don't know if that's a goal of yours. I've, like I said, I've listened to some of your podcasts. It doesn't seem to be, but maybe you can start a new trend.
I don't think I've ever had, I mean, I might have had a couple of lumps in the throat, but I don't think I've ever had anybody full. I mean, not that I recall.
I'm not a wailer. I mean, I just, I cry a lot. And I think, I mean, I'm one of the, I'm like a little kid in that way. Like I sort of, I have a feeling, I cry and then I'm like, okay, you want to go get ice cream? You know, I mean, it's not like it's something that throws me into like this, you know, existential angst or depression or anything. It's like, I have a feeling, I deal with it and then I move on.
Right.
But anyway, so Sam, 30 pages, call me, you know, I tormented her into teaching a private workshop basically by bribing her and saying that I would be, you know, her assistant to coordinate it because she was like, I'm busy. I don't want to, I can't. And she did. So I worked in a workshop with Sam for about 8 or 9 months. And she was like, look, you're writing a memoir, honey, whether you know it or not, you are, you're putting all the little pearls like into your little, you know, into your little basket and the string will appear. Just trust yourself and you should start applying for shit. So I did. I mean, you know, I applied to McDowell and I applied to Yotto and the Prague Summer Program and Norman Mailer, like this whole host of things. And I started getting them, you know, which was not Yotto, fuckers, but which was kind of amazing. And, you know, so I would go off to these places and some of them were fellowships and some of them were residencies and some of them were, you know, more generative. Like I went to the Atlantic Center and worked with Honor Moore for a month and went to the New York Summer Writers Institute and worked with Marilyn Robinson. And that's how I sort of cut my teeth, you know, just going, you know, just sort of bouncing around to all of these places that would have me, and immersing myself in the writing community. But, oh, I know where I was going. There people, you know, so first trip to McDowell and only at this point, 2007, I've got 50 pages under my belt and I roll up and I'm there with Andrew Solomon and I'm there with Nam Lee and Bill Finnegan and, you know, and a bunch of other people who, by the way, all three of those men, amazing. I mean, I thank them in my acknowledgments because they were so, so very kind to me. But then there's also the people who I will not name who are like, oh, you dropped out of high school in the 10th grade? That's interesting. So how did you get here, you know, over dinner? Or, oh, you're writing a memoir. Well, you must have had a very interesting life. You know, and just like there's literary citizenship that can help you grow. And there's lack of literary citizenship that can be very stunting. And I just feel very fortunate that I've had some exemplary literary citizens along the way who have been willing to just sort of hold their hand out. And, you know, like one of my benchmarks for, you know, after 5 minutes of conversation with you in a room, whether it's at AWP or, you know, like whatever party we're at, and someone says like, have you read whatever? And if the answer is no, and it's something that they're, you know, it's something from the Pantheon and they're a fan of it, they'll light up and go like, oh my God, I'm so excited because it's this, this, and this. Whereas if it's a person who goes like, oh, you haven't,
right,
it's like, yeah, you're crossed off my list, dude.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
see ya.
Snobs.
Yeah. Fuck off. Like,
right. Well, but I mean, you know, you forged your own way. And I, to be honest with you, I feel like when it comes to doing this stuff, it's about reading and writing. It's about doing the work.
Yeah.
And you know, whether you do that in the context of, you know, institutional learning, where it can be, you know, that can work. Plenty of great writers have gotten their MFAs, or you do it on your own and you're self-taught and you find your own mentors and you, you know, do the work independent of an institution. Either way works. That's sort of the, you know, that's kind of the beauty of it. It's rare. Some, you know, it's a rare profession that can say that. So, I applaud you for, you know, for persevering, because you were dealt a much tougher hand than most of us. And, you know, it's a great story and I'm going to be looking forward to that memoir. I mean, I got to believe that memoir is coming.
Well, it's, you know, it exists in pieces. It's in tatters under my bed. And now the question is, of course, do I move to that, or which is a love of mine for sure. Or do I continue in the vein of this heartful, I hope, but breezy commercial work that, you know, I'm not going to lie, has been very lucrative for me.
Right. Well,
the intersection of art and commerce, my friend.
So what you got, was there a bidding war over it?
There was not a bidding war. There was a preempt.
Okay.
I was in the first person who read it was Denise Roy at Dutton, and she actually had she said she wanted to acquire it, but had some suggestions about like some plot stuff that she wanted me to address, which was sort of, you know, like, wait, you want me to address them before you buy it? You know, I was wary about that. And there were a couple of other people in the mix, but I did go ahead and do that. And then she came back, and my agent sort of left me out of the, like, I didn't want to be involved in the moment by moment of that because I'm so neurotic about that stuff. And I try to drive the bus. But she ended up coming back and saying, you know, like, here's this big fat preempt from Dutton. And, you know, and I was super happy to take it.
Sure.
After.
All right. And what about, do you have another novel going at all, or is it, all upstairs?
It's pretty much all upstairs at this point. I have two, it could go one of two ways. And then, you know, and then the memoir's kind of calling me. So I don't know. We'll see.
All right. Well, I wish you well with it, and I thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk. It's been real fun, you know, hearing your story as difficult as it was at points. And it's like I said, hats off to you for, you know, doing what you're doing and for having such a good sense of humor. And
thanks, Brad.
I wish you well.
And I can't wait to hopefully our paths will cross again. We've met once actually, but hopefully our paths will cross again in the real world and soon.